All we need is love.
All we need is love.
All we need is love. All we need is love. Look, it's more dudes up in prisons than up in schools. We need more schools equipping us with the tools. It's evident that we built to survive, set up to lose.
Well, hello, everyone out there. Welcome to another episode of the Palisades Podcast. This is our July episode. We're so happy to have you all with us today because not that we don't usually have a very special guest, but today we have a really special guest. You just heard his music. His name is Paul Davis. He goes by PD locally in the Palisades. And we're really getting very excited to get to know him. I know him through basketball. He happens to be the rock star coach for my kid who plays basketball and another couple of hundred Palisadian kids, and he'll tell us about that. But he also has an incredible life story. He was born in 1989, so he's quite a spring chicken compared to the other two people in this room. But we'll go over it and we'll get to know somebody really formidable, a remarkable man who lives in Pacific Palisades and definitely makes an impact on the lives of so many Palisadians. So I'm Maryam Czar. I'm here with my co-host, Steve Krohn. We have been now doing this either remotely, virtually, or with proper social distancing for like 3 or 4 months. So as usual, let me ask you, how's it going during this time of pandemic?
Well, like everybody, it's the same thing every day, more or less, a few little wrinkles, but we're following the rules and just waiting for this to end, whenever that is. But, you know, we're staying healthy, being safe, following the protocols, and hoping that everybody else does too, so we can get through this.
At least you don't have to send a kid back to school in a couple of weeks. That's kind of crazy. We're, I'm sure everybody in the Palisades is thinking about it, but in a couple of months, it's going to be kind of funny to see how many kids go back to school, under what kind of circumstances. I don't know, maybe next month we'll talk to somebody about school, because that'll be an interesting start.
True.
All right. So today we've got Paul Davis. Paul, how long have you lived in the Palisades? I know you left for a while, you came back, but the first time.
7 years now. 7 years.
So a 7-year Palisadian. Take it away, Steve.
That counts as a Palisadian in my book. So, PD, you and I have had the pleasure of knowing each other for about 15 minutes now. Well, I don't think we'd ever seen each other. We certainly have never talked. And so I'm kind of winging it. I know a little bit about you from information that I've gleaned from Miriam and other people. I've heard about you as a fixture in the Palisades, but as is my training as a lawyer, what I want to do is kind of go back and start from 1989 and figure out how you got here, because it wasn't your traditional move of a lot of people in the Palisades. They buy a starter house somewhere else and they finally get to realize their dream of moving to the Palisades and buying a better house, whatever. You came in a different way. And so I'd like to go back, and I know you were born in 1989. Where were you raised?
I was born 1989, Santa Monica Hospital. My uncle was watching the Bulls versus the Lakers game, so that probably was a great start to my life as a basketball player. I was born and raised in South Central, specifically West Adams District, and we moved around a lot just to avoid certain gangs and violence, depending on the age, between Inglewood, South Central, Hawthorne, Burbank, you name it. We just kept moving, and then we ended up pretty much consistently between Inglewood and South Central.
Okay, so when in my early start of my career, I was a public defender here in L.A. County. So I worked in areas of Compton and South L.A. So I've seen the underbelly of that, you know, what the crime, the violence, at least back in the 70s and 80s. But for those among our listeners who don't know anything about it, can you describe in a few sentences what life was like back then?
Life was very fragile. It's still fragile to me now, but you had to always watch your back. You had a sense of cautiousness, but at the same time, a sense of power within yourself as an individual, knowing that you would have to be prepared to stand up for yourself at any given moment. And then you always had to protect somebody. Like, I always had to protect my siblings. I always felt the obligation to have to look over the four of them because I knew it wasn't safe. And at any given moment, something could happen. And you had Bloods, you had Crips, you had Hispanic gangs that were ruthless to where they would kill their best friends. So you knew you would be shot in a second. You had all types of gangs and nonsense. And my father was actually a really well-known Crip within the neighborhoods. So that automatically associated me with some sort of reputation in that regard. Which
PD, were you the oldest child? Are you the oldest of your siblings?
I am the oldest of five.
So you, it sounds like you had to act like a father at a young age.
I was a father. I was probably a father figure, age 7, 8 years old.
And how did you, looking back, how did you stay out of, well, I assume you did. I assume you didn't grow up and become a Crip or a Blood. Maybe I'm jumping to conclusions, but how did you stay out of that as a lifestyle?
I made the conscious decision to always do the opposite of what I knew wasn't right. So my father was an alcoholic. I hated alcohol. A lot of my relatives did drugs. I despised drugs. Gangs, they always bothered me. They always made me nervous and anxious. So I never did it, though my younger siblings did. Some of my greatest friends did. But I never judged them. I just kind of, I tried to look out for them to a certain extent to where I knew it wouldn't affect me in regards of, you know, being harmed.
But in reading a brief bio about you, you had some incidents that came close to ending it all for you. Is that right?
Yeah, I've had numerous incidents.
Before we go there, because okay, we're getting a little older, I want to go back to when you were a kid. Because again, I know you as an adult, but I want to go back to when you were a kid. So you're the oldest of five. What's the age difference between you and your youngest sibling?
I am 30. The next one under me is Brittany, my sister, who's 28. And then it's Staircase from there. It's my brother LaBrie's 27, Dominique's 26. And Byron is 26 as well, which explains that my mother adopted my brothers.
Two of them?
Yes.
LaBrie
and Byron were both adopted.
Got it.
Totally different situations. And my sisters and I are my mother's biological children. And my mother was actually adopted as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I'm her first blood that she ever met.
So your mom was adopted when she was little?
Birth, her and my uncle.
And where did they grow? Where in the States did they grow up?
They grew up in the Pacific Palisades. They were adopted by my grandmother and grandfather. My grandfather was a well-renowned doctor, Amos Anthony Davis, in Cedars-Sinai. I mean, he was, before he passed away, he was a big-time, excellent doctor, excellent person.
That's amazing.
And he widowed my grandmother, who still resides in the Palisades, 40 years. And they adopted my mother and my uncle.
So when you were growing up, I want you to tell me a little bit about your mother, because she was a single mom, right?
My mom became a single mom relatively quick. She had me at 20. And my dad was really abusive. So it was only a matter of time before my mother made the decision to take us away from him,
right?
This setting.
Which makes your mom a pretty tough woman. I mean, a very strong woman, because it's not easy to have kids, you know, maybe not have a thriving career and still decide to walk away. I mean, I work in the world of women and abuse, and it's just not that easy to walk away. So I've got to attribute a great deal of strength to your mom. I mean, how did she impact you growing up? I mean, you stayed clean in a place where it was tough to stay clean. You know, you held on to some pretty good values that we still see today. How'd your mom impact your life? I mean, when you sent us your life story, your mom came up in the second sentence. So tell me what moms mean to kids growing up.
Moms mean, I mean, that's the birth of a nation. When you think of it, without mothers, and we don't really have what we have today, life. When I think of my mom, I think of strength. I think of emotion. I think of resilience. I think of perseverance. I think of fight. My mother has emotional issues from her birth, from being adopted, from growing up in a predominantly white neighborhood and being called a lot of racial things attending Pali High. And she was called everything you can imagine. And she's very dark complexion. So she dealt with a lot of emotional things and still does to this day. She also was diagnosed with heart disease at an early age and Marfan's later in her life as well. So as a kid, I could remember maybe 50% of each school year, my mom would be in the hospital.
Wow.
She's had two open heart surgeries. So sometimes my coaches picked us up and took us to school and brought us back home. And we would be home with just me.
That's crazy.
To help the kids with their homework. And
So at those times you were acting as the father and the mother.
Yeah, I inherited it. I had to because she was sick. And my grandmother lived in the Palisades. And she wasn't going to come down to South Central to come tend to us.
So you ended up at Pali High because your mom knew that there was a Pali High?
No, we ended up at Pali High because I requested it.
Oh.
Ninth grade, I went to Westchester High because I was recruited to play basketball there.
Oh, okay.
With a lot of former and current NBA guys. It was a big-time basketball school back then. Still is, but...
What was the name of the coach at Westchester? He was a famous
Coach Azam.
Guy. Yeah, famous
coach
guy.
Coach Azam. Yeah, he is. He's won a lot of basketball games. So freshman year, I played there.
Wow.
But there was a Mexican versus Black war going on at that time. So I would walk at the gym, and you would see 20-year-old Hispanics hopping the fence into the high school.
Wow.
Fighting, stabbing anybody that looked like me.
This is Westchester?
Westchester
like 20
high.
Miles, yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
So then how did you get transferred to Pali?
I told my mom. I said, you know, I want to transfer because I want to focus on school and ball, and I can't do it here. And I said, let's use Nana's address, my grandmother's address. We used it. I got in, and I had a phenomenal 3 years.
And what year was that?
2004. Yeah, 2004.
All right, so I'm going to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You say when your mom went to Pali High, it was, you know, I guess racial tensions were high and she had to deal with slurs. Mm. Tell me you didn't. Did you have to? Did you feel racial tension at Pali High? Yeah,
no,
back
when I attended, everybody loved me, but it was for obvious reasons.
What, your good looks?
No, I was a basketball player.
Oh.
So like we were like,
and your good looks.
We were like the favorites there. And then I had a couple issues with specific teachers. I had a art teacher who really didn't like me. I don't know why, but I never jumped to conclusions. And then I had a math teacher who didn't like me either. For no reason, but things happen. I mean, people have their own perspective on things. That's fine.
So you played basketball for Pali High?
I sure did. I loved it. I loved it.
How'd the team do while you were on?
We did really well. We were always undersized, and we always had to come third to Fairfax and Westchester because they had all the pro guys. But, I mean, I loved being a 6-foot power forward and having to guard all the 6'8", 6'9 guys. It really made me tougher. And a lot of my friends that I still have today are from that team.
We were talking before, and before we leave South Central and move completely to the Palisades, I remember in reading your bio, you talked about having had a couple of incidents where you were the victim of gun violence in South Central. Is that right?
Yeah, I've had tons. Tons that happened close to me and tons that happened, well, a couple that happened directly to me. When I was 16, my brother and I were victims of a drive-by shooting. So we were at our house, and my mom was out on a date, which she rarely went on dates. So it was interesting that was the night. And we were on the computer, and there were always drive-bys. I mean, once or twice a week. It was pretty reoccurring. So we were used to it. Helicopters every other night, used to it. 5 gunshots straight through our screen door. We had a wood door. We had a screen door, and the wood door was open. The wooden door was open. Went through the screen, went straight through my neck. My brother was facing me sitting down, so it went through me and knocked out three or four of his teeth. And he was face down on the floor, covering his face. And I hadn't really processed the fact that he was shot. I had the reflex just to grab my neck, and I felt like the air coming out of my body. And I saw my sisters in the kitchen crying. And my cousin was sitting on the couch. And I've never seen his face so blank. He was quiet and he was just staring at me. So I looked on the floor and I realized LaBrie was kicking. And I realized, oh, wow, I got shot.
Wow.
I was really surprised. So I walked outside, and my uncle lived next door at the time because we lived in a complex where my grandmother owned it. So we lived next to each other on Edge Hill Drive. And I walked down the hill holding my neck, and I knocked on his door, and he just started yelling and cursing and sat me down and put a towel around my neck, and I held it. And all I could think about was, I don't want to die. I got so much left to do. I want to play ball. I want to go to college. I still want to try to go to the NBA. Like, I just kept replaying everything. And I just, you know, I was visualizing my future. And I never forget this lady, who I talk about all the time. She walked from the bottom of the hill. It was like her shadow. I can't even remember the way she looked, but I could hear her voice. And she walked up to the steps, and she prayed over me. She just kept saying, God, please take care of this young man. He's not done yet. He's got so much more life in store. Please keep your angels around him. Please get him through. Please allow him to live. And she prayed over me. And all I can remember after that is being in the ambulance and two white paramedics talking about a girl that he dated the night before.
Laughing, wow. While you were bleeding in the...
It's like, man, how'd it go? And like, bro, she was hot, snot, and they were laughing. And it bothered me because I didn't understand why they were focused on that, where a young kid was just dying. And it made me feel like a statistic. It made me feel like they do this so often that it's just another night in South Central. And I woke up 4 days later out of a coma in ICU. And I asked where my brother was. And the first question I asked was, where was Liberty? And he was in the room next to me. And I was relieved that he wasn't dead.
Wow, you're lucky to be alive.
How did Liberty get to the hospital? And so just for everyone to know, Liberty was the brother that you were sitting next to. The bullet that went through your neck hit Liberty in the face?
Yes.
All right, how did he get to the hospital?
The paramedics, I don't know. I never asked that question. But
so
a different ambulance came.
And he was next to you.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So after that experience, which potentially was deadly, how did that change you? Or did that make you more committed to leaving South Central, going to the Palisades? Or was it, can you reflect back on what effect that had on your life?
I always had fuel. I always had a sense of urgency. Ever since I was a kid, I just knew that I wanted to be in a better place, in a better world, and I just wanted to make sure that I got to a certain point, a platform, a status to where I could help people just like me, no matter their color. But I knew that people were going through what I was going through. I knew there were people dealing with trauma, and I had a sense of urgency. But after that, there was fuel to the fire for sure, and I knew without a doubt I was leaving for college. Like, my next focus was college. My mother wanted me to go to Cal State, LA, Northridge. She wanted me to stay close. I knew without a doubt I had to leave. So I left.
So at that point, you were a junior?
I was a junior, and I made it to the first day of school. And
that's amazing.
Played my senior year. It was rough.
That's incredible.
You mentioned when you were in the ambulance, the two paramedics that were talking about a date the night before, and you mentioned that they were white.
Yeah.
Was that significant to you? Did you feel like it was the blacks were being victimized by either the police or the paramedics or white people in charge of that area?
Not victimized. Race has just always been a thing. I mean, when you're born in a certain neighborhood and I've had white neighbors and they've been great. They've been phenomenal. But when you live in that neighborhood, and every time you get pulled over, it's a white cop. And every time you see somebody walk to the other side of the street and it's a white woman. Mm. Or every time it's a paramedic and it's a white guy and he's laughing. Or you go to a white doctor and you seem like you're less important than someone else. It becomes a stigma that becomes a fact, that becomes a reoccurring thing that you have to accept. And since a kid, I wasn't taught that. I observed everything. I have photographic memory, which is probably why I battle with a bipolar disorder to this day, which I wanted to talk about, mental health.
We will.
But
So would it be fair to say that you felt like, from your experience, Black Lives, well, to use today's parlance, Black Lives Matter, but at that time it felt like your Black life was worth less than a white life to many of the white people you dealt with.
Oh, it absolutely felt like that. Black and brown.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it always felt like that.
So when I asked you to join us on the Pally podcast, I asked you to send, you know, to like give us a primer of who PD is beyond the PD that I know from the present day. And you sent this beautiful and moving few pages of your life story, which I wouldn't mind publishing in the Pulitzer Center. but it's, as I was reading it, it happened to be a day when I had joined a webinar for Susan Burton. And so for those of you who don't know, Susan Burton is a woman who was incarcerated over and over again in her life. And each time she came out, she would end up back in jail. And eventually she gets out one time and she decides that she's not going to go back. And so she finds that she has very few skills with which to pound out a life. And so she finds herself facing homelessness. And that sort of motivates her to get to a place where she can help other people, a lot like what you're saying, where she can help other women who are coming out of prison be able to get a job and stand on their own 2 feet and not either face homelessness or recidivism and go back to jail. And she is now very successful. She's written a book. She runs a center. She helps people. She's quite successful. I happened to be on a webinar listening to her and her daughter. Her daughter is someone who is highly accomplished, who's learned a lot from her mother. And someone asked her to tell us what her life was like as a kid when her mom was in and out of jail. And she said, you know, I was that little Black girl who wanted to go to school and wanted to get an education and wanted to stay clean and wanted to have a future. But everybody would treat me not that way, right? So she says there were cops in the neighborhood that would like look down on me, harass me, or, you know, people would come up to me and just assume that I was a little girl who had no future. And all I was trying to do was struggle through my studies to prove that I had a future. And that was incredibly moving to me. And then I kind of opened up my laptop and read your story. And this passage jumped out at me. So I'm going to read it, if you guys don't mind, because it's really kind of interesting. And you don't have to comment on it. We can move on. But if you do, you can comment on it. I just think it's important for people to realize this. You say, I remember walking home and cops would stare at me the whole way down the block. I walked in fear, thinking I was going to go to jail. My ignorance and nativity, not processing the fact that I hadn't committed any crime. I was just scared. The community kind of recycled this fear, and certain experiences validated that fear. One day, my mother was outside, and a cop pulled up to our apartment and asked her if she was a blood. She was wearing a red nightgown that she sleeps in and a brown scarf. He then proceeded to put my mom on her knees as I stood and watched as a 10-year-old kid. I took my sisters inside and came back to see that he had my mom's arms locked, and he kept asking her the same question over and over again, and she was sweating and panting because her chest was hurting from the strain. I mean, that was 20 years ago. Here we are today. We hear the same stories. We just now have video footage of this stuff. I mean, I'm not going to get into this conversation if you guys don't want to, but it seems to me like generations have been facing the same set of stuff. And maybe if today we talk about Black Lives Matter or rethinking police departments, it's because so many kids have experienced this.
Do you want to comment?
No comment.
Okay. I get it. And I just want to say one thing is that I mentioned that I was a public defender a long time ago. And we used to hear the same stories all the time. Black or brown person walking down the street, getting harassed by police, getting beaten up, getting assaulted in various ways. And we would do what we could to defend these people the best way we could, interviewing, investigating witnesses, looking for anything. There weren't videos at the time. And we heard these stories over and over and over, and there was no doubt in my mind and the minds of everybody I work with, these stories were true. We just kept hearing them and kept hearing them, but we didn't have the proof. And what the difference is now, and the only difference, I don't think anything's changed very much, but the difference now is the existence of cell phones with cameras. Because now, sometimes you get video that says, oh, that officer's not telling the truth. There's, you know, what this defendant is saying is truthful and the officer's not being honest. And, you know, there, I don't think I need to say this, there's many great police officers. I have friends with some of them. This is not an indictment of law enforcement, but it is certainly a statement that says there are periodic cases where law enforcement acts totally inappropriately, and oftentimes the victims are black or brown.
All right. So you wanted to move on and then give back. And so now you're a senior in high school and you get to go away to college. And you do. Was it basketball that got you into college? Was it Whittier first?
No, it was Hampton University first.
Hampton first.
It's a tiny speck of a school.
It's like
the size of a parking lot, right?
It's
tiny.
Incredible.
Where is it?
In Virginia.
You really did go away.
I did. It was awesome.
Tell us about Virginia. Tell us about Hampton College. Did you play basketball?
I did. It was phenomenal. I emailed the coach all throughout the school year. I sent them my film, and they didn't have any scholarships available. So I had one last AAU basketball tournament in Vegas, saw the assistant coach, asked him again. I academically had already been accepted, so I told him, I said, hey, I'm going to decide to come to the school. Do you think I can get a scholarship? And he said, we don't have any available, but we'll allow you to walk on if you do well at the tryouts. I came, got into school, worked my butt off, made the team. 2 months later, I had the highest GPA on the team. I tutored the seniors and juniors, and he gave me a scholarship. It opened up. Somebody had got hurt. I got a scholarship for the remainder of the season.
And that's amazing.
It was a really great year. I learned a lot. I learned how to watch film. I learned how to lift weights. I got to the gym before everybody. I left last. And my work ethic just boomed from there. My game changed and my mentality changed. And I felt like a little pro then.
Aww.
It was a great year for me. And, you know, it was hard at the same time because it was the first time I was away from my siblings and my mom. And I felt kind of handicapped because I knew that they needed me there. But it was the first time I did something selfish. First time. And I call it selfish because I always put everybody first. And I was always doing something for someone.
Why didn't you stay there?
That's exactly why. I couldn't be selfish any longer. So I came back. All four of my siblings dropped out the year I went to college.
Dropped out of high school?
Yes. All four. And some were sophomores. One was a junior and the rest were, and then one was freshman. They all dropped out. And my mom just got really bad. And I came back for the summer. And I just started working out. I was always gone. And I just felt the pressure of having to stay home. So I decided to not go back. And I attended El Camino College, played there, got some financial aid, and met my children's mom. You know, I was...
So hang on. How far is El Camino from here?
It's in the
Torrance.
Oh, so not that far. PD, you say that when you were off at Hampton, you thought you were doing something selfish, but I mean, arguably you were just becoming the PD you had to be able to reach back out and help everybody now. So maybe not so selfish.
I should have stayed. that's a regret.
If you had, you know, we always look, we're old guys. We know you can say I should have stayed, but on the other hand, maybe your siblings might
have really needed to
not come out on top.
Right.
You never know.
What was Virginia like? Was it different? Like, was the East Coast vibe different for you?
I've always had it. People have always thought I was from the East Coast. I've always had that just the way I am. Like, work hard first, play later, like, get straight down to business. I've always had that mentality. So when I got there, people were calling me Cali Boy, but a month later, people were calling me PD because they realized, like, this dude don't stop. At 6 in the morning before class, I'd be working out in the snow.
It was the
first time I was in the snow. So I was wearing basketball shorts and Chuck Taylors in the snow. Like, so what? Let's go. Put your hoodie on. Let's do it.
I love that. It sounds like your work ethic is definitely exceptional. And goodness knows, everybody we've heard of that ever succeeded in life pushed beyond a limit, definitely pushed beyond a limit, and you're no exception.
Thank you.
So you come back, and then you went to Whittier? Well, El Camino, and then Whittier, and played basketball everywhere you went in college, right?
I played basketball everywhere. People don't know this, but I actually, Seton Hall was one of my favorite schools growing up. I just loved it.
That's in New Jersey.
New Jersey. I just loved watching them play their teams. I loved their coaching. And for some reason, I just fell in love with them. So out of junior college, I actually applied there and I got in. And they didn't have family housing for me to accommodate me and my wife at the time and my 1 and 2 year old. Yeah, I had a newborn and a 1 year old. They're 11 months apart. As a 20 year old sophomore in college. So my new life began. So I decided to go to Whittier because the coach really liked me. And they got me an apartment and it was a phenomenal private college. And the academics were great. So I got all types of scholarships for academics and stuff. And then I still had a little bit I had to pay, but you know.
It's where Nixon went, right?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Actually. Wow.
Phenomenal school. I learned a lot really fast. Junior year all the way to halfway through my senior year where I dropped out.
And so that you was with it. Wife and two children.
I had three at that point after that. Well, I didn't have three till I graduated. Well, until I left college. I dropped out midway through my senior year.
Why did you drop out then when you were so close?
I was emotionally drained, working two jobs, having a great year in basketball, juggling school, kids, and I had a dream of playing professionally and playing overseas, which I was probably a year and a half away from doing so. And I went into a deep depression, and I told my coach I couldn't play anymore, and I left.
And at this point, you're a 20-year-old man?
I was 21, 22.
You've already lived a lifetime, and you're 21 or 22. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
And so then where did you ultimately did graduate, right?
No, still haven't.
You're half a semester short?
Literally half a semester, 12, 15 units specifically.
But you did make it to pro basketball.
I did. I made it to many forms of it. And I even turned down some contracts because I started my wonderful program.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your pro career. Where did you play first?
Wow. I mean, I went everywhere. I didn't have any representation. I had one agent and all he did was take money from me and without giving me opportunities. So that I realized that was a fraudulent situation. Out of college, my senior year, I moved in with my mom and I told her I wouldn't be there longer than 3-4 months, not to worry. I moved in. I slept on the couch with my sons when I had them. I was gone 6 a.m. and I didn't come home till 10, 11 p.m. every day. I saved up. I trained everybody. I worked out with the G League. I was given an opportunity to enter the G League draft, the NBA G League draft at the time. It was the NBA D League at that time. Now it's the G League. Bakersfield Jam gave me an opportunity. I was in the draft. I made it through a month. And then they gave my spot to a veteran from the San Antonio Spurs, Antonio Daniels, yeah. So that was a great experience. After that, I had trials with the Phoenix Suns, Utah Jazz. I was just plugging away, making calls, and I was trying out everywhere. I didn't get any of those jobs, but the experience was crazy, and I apply my lessons to today. I then started going to overseas combines in Las Vegas, Philadelphia, where I got an offer to play Australia. But at the time, I got an offer to play in Sydney, Australia, which was a dream. It was such an overwhelming thing that I didn't even tell anybody. There was a point where I had my first youth program called PhD Pally Hoop Dreams, and I had got my own apartment in the Pacific Palisades, my first apartment. I got my first car. Everything was on my own terms. It was the first time I made $1,000 like in a week. It was the first time I got a large amount of money. And then I weighed that with the contract and a 7-month contract to go to Sydney, Australia and play for X amount of dollars compared to coaching and training Pally Hoop Dreams in the Palisades and being with my sons. So I had to make a decision to leave at the genesis of this program. And 7 months away from my sons for the first time. So I made a selfless decision to stay. Then I played semi-professionally, VB, Venice Basketball League. I mean, I averaged 28 points a game. I played with China, a Chinese team that came down every summer. I played with them. Phenomenal. Led them in scoring and assists. I played in the Drew League, the famous Drew League, where all the NBA players play for 6 years. Phenomenal opportunities, and I just embraced it all. I embraced it all. And then I was offered, at 28, I was offered an opportunity to play in Africa, and I got it. I had a tryout, and it was phenomenal. I killed it. I was feeling good. It was my fourth workout of the day. I mean, I had two games and a workout. And I showed up to the workout, and I was so, like, juiced that I just killed it. And the next week, I ruptured my Achilles.
Oh, so this brings us pretty close to recent history, right? Pally Hoops Dreams, your Achilles, that's within the last five years.
Yeah.
So let me just ask. So as of up until the last few years, you've still been pursuing the dream of playing basketball.
I stopped pursuing after the Achilles, but I'm still playing. Like, even now, the quarantine got me. Like, now I work two times a day. I'm working out two times a day again. I'm getting back in best shape ever. And I'm always open to opportunities because I still get calls to come work out and come try out a different place.
You're 30 now?
I'm 30, yes. Yeah. I'll be 31 next month.
I assume you're a guard.
I am a point guard.
Yeah.
Yeah, my size. Yeah. My size sells that.
May not mean much to you, but given his size.
Complete gibberish.
He would not be a forward or a center.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
I didn't even know there were positions in basketball.
Well, the
game's
changing.
Like they're running around.
The game is changing now. It's becoming more positionless. You got 6'10 guys bringing the ball down court now.
PD, when did music enter your life? Well, hold on. I'm old enough to remember a time when there was no rap. So tell me, when you were growing up, was there rap?
It was hip hop.
It was hip hop.
And that's what I'm trying to bring back in a sense. I'm trying to hold on to it because we've lost that culture.
Yeah. So when did music enter your consciousness? Like, when did you realize?
Since birth.
Yeah?
Yeah, my mom wrote poetry.
Oh,
all
wow.
the time. That was her getaway. My godfather, who was the closest thing to a father figure, and that lasted for a short amount of time, he was a musician. He was insane. He played the piano. He rapped. He sang. He danced. I remember hearing him hum like 3 a.m, humming songs like 3-4 minutes straight, different notes and melodies. And that just, I used to fall asleep. We had to rotate bedrooms because we only had two bedrooms. So we had to rotate. So I would sleep on the floor in the living room on pallet, and I would play my little speaker. We had MySpace back then, and there was a music app. I still can't remember, but I played Erykah Badu and Lauryn Hill every night, all night. I slept to my music, and it would just give me peace. And I started writing poetry at about 10 or 11, and then I started doing creative writing about 13. Then I started writing music around like 18 when I heard J. Cole. And he was a great storyteller, and he talked about like things that I could really relate to, about just a young black kid growing up, and it really just inspired me. And then I met an English teacher. I was an English major first in college before I went to international business as I planned to play overseas. And Dr. Winfield, I can remember her. She was a Virginia native. She helped me start writing an autobiography. Yeah, and I started writing it, and I never got to finish it because I left, but she saw my interest in writing and my love for it, and we started writing. And from 19 to now, I've been writing. I write a song a day at least. I have over 250 songs.
That's amazing, PD. So you've had music in your ear since you were tiny, and you have a penchant for writing.
When you write songs, do you play instruments? Do you do the music too, or do you have... How do you get the music done?
Instrumentals. I listen to instrumentals more than I listen to words. I don't listen to other people's words because unless they're meaningful, it's energy so strong that if I hear a rap song that has degrading words or any type of negative energy in it, it'll penetrate my energy, and my energy is very sensitive. So I listen to instrumentals, 94.7 The Wave. But when I write, sometimes I write when I'm in the car. Like, I'll freestyle something, a line, and I'll add to it throughout the day. and I'll add to it throughout the week. And by Friday, I'll have a song, and then I'll listen to a beat. Like last night, I listened to maybe 90 beats. So from 11 p.m. to 2 in the morning, I listened to 85, 90 beats, and I found like three that went with the lyrics that I had. So I'll literally just listen, and I'll find it, and I'll piece it up.
So your lyrics come from an inspiration. It's something you want to get. Yeah.
However I feel. Like I've been really emotional lately, just down my mental lately. So last night was a splurge event. And last week it was just talking about the times, social injustices and peace of mind. And it was great. You know, it'll depend on how I feel.
So did I read that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're... The mother of your children is Iranian?
Yeah, she's Persian. Her father's from Iran.
So are you still in touch with her or her family?
Oh, no, not her family. Her father and I had a phenomenal relationship. He was amazing. He left Iran at a young age, and he was actually living in South Central a lot. So he understood the demographic. He understood the culture. And he's a good dude, really great heart. My kid's mom is great. She's a great mother, phenomenal mother. We just have our differences. Her uncle worked in law enforcement. Very
bigoted.
Racist. Yeah, he hated me from the start. Didn't even have to hear a word out of my mouth. We had an altercation, and he cost me a job. I was a JV coach at Pali High, which was my dream job, was to be a varsity coach at Pali High, which I probably would have been right now. My alma mater has been phenomenal. And I train and coach all the kids in the Palisades. So it's like, I mean, a smooth transition for my guys. You know what I mean? That's, when I think about it, it's a lot of state championships. But there was an altercation at his home when we lived with him for a little while. And my wife at the time and I were having an argument, and he pointed a gun in my face and had the most hatred in his eyes I've ever seen. And he called me every racial slur you could ever hear. And I didn't even know some of those words existed. And I will never forget that. It was the first time I was put in handcuffs, and last. First time I was sat in the back of a police car, and I felt like a criminal, but I felt so afraid that I thought I was just gonna go to jail for no reason. I thought that was gonna tarnish my reputation, and I thought I was gonna have a felony on my record, and
everything you had avoided your whole life,
mm-hmm.
out of this one racist guy.
Yeah, and I was accused of assault with a deadly weapon.
And the case was dismissed, or not?
It was dismissed the day after that. My job was lost the next morning. I got an email being fired from Dr. McGee, who was has a reputation for I hate to throw her under the bus for she was fired from Culver City and then came to Pali as a new principal. She didn't like me either. I was very popular on the campus, and she never supported me. So I was fired the next morning via email.
Because they found out about the arrest?
He sent it to the school.
Oh, he went out of his way to let him know.
Yeah, he sent it directly to the school.
Because it's not normally a public record.
No, he sent it directly. And then the morning after that, the charges were dropped. Everything was dropped.
But you didn't get your job back?
Nope. Never got it back.
Another interesting incident happened at Pali High. I'm just going to take you back a few years. Mayor at the time, Villaraigosa, didn't he give you a shout out?
He sure did.
What happened?
I was second team. I made the second team All-Star, All-League my senior year. And there was a warehouse shoe sale hoop scholastic jam where the top student athletes of our Western League were invited to play an All-Star game. Every player was required to write an essay about a challenge they had to face, one of the hardest challenges they had to face growing up or as a youth in their life as a student athlete. And I wrote about being a victim of the drive-by shooting.
Mm.
And I won the competition, and Mayor Villaraigosa gave me a certificate of acknowledgement in that regard, and it was phenomenal. And then the All-Star game was fantastic as well.
Yeah. I want to say that's really cool. I mean, I want to reinforce the idea that your English teacher over at Hampton University introduced to you a few years ago about that autobiography. Is it still out there? Can you dust it off and take a look again?
I can't find it, and I've looked everywhere for
it. No way.
And I can't find her contact.
We're going to have to help you get back there again, because I feel like you write.
I wouldn't be opposed to it.
You definitely write. I mean, even writing music is a little bit of poetry, right? Maybe you have that from, you know, your mom, you said, wrote poetry. You definitely have a lot to say, and there's inspiration that's in your music, and your life is so incredibly varied. Like, who gets shot and then gets something from the mayor? So,
well, it wasn't exactly one follow the other. It's not like he got an award, but there was a cause and effect. Yeah. I want to follow up one question I was going to ask you. And are your kids, would you consider them bicultural? I know they're biracial, but are they bicultural? Like, do they identify with the African American culture that you bring and the Persian culture that your wife brings to the relationship?
I would honestly say, well, they're learning Farsi for sure. But in regards to culture, I mean, their grandfather instills as much culture as he can, but he's always gone because he builds wind turbines. So he's always like in different states. Yeah, he's a worker.
Sounds like an interesting guy.
Yeah, it's tough. He's always gone. But I think they might be tricultural because of them being raised in the Pacific Palisades, partially.
Oh, so you get the white Palisades.
And you get my...
They get you, and they got the...
Because they're pretty versatile as young human beings, because they don't even realize it, but they've been raised in so many different places because I've had to move so many places. And they were born and raised in a gym.
Yeah.
So they're like basketball junkies.
They're quadricultural. Add
the gym.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think your kids, black and Persian, but you know, they essentially strike me as just local, like local kids.
Yeah.
If you compared your life growing up, I guess your awareness of racial tensions, and you look at theirs, is it even comparable?
No. My kids have 100 times way better life than I have already.
Yeah.
And I teach them, but I protect them. I don't, because the more they know, the more they have to feel what I feel. And I knew too much too early.
Yeah.
And that's why I battle with the things I battle with to this day.
Do you think, I mean, when you look across what's going on now, do you think there's fundamental change on the horizon, you know, that's different than what you've been seeing for the last 30 years? Or you think it's lip service and it's all going to be the same?
I pray there's change. I'm hopeful always. I always have faith. But I believe that when I see it, then it is. And I just want to make sure I play my part, which is why I'm trying to become a member of the city council. And I'm trying to get on a record label as a musician. And I'm trying to make sure that every lane I have is executed so that you can't ignore my voice.
Do you... We're often told as a white guy that black parents have to have the conversation with their African-American sons how to handle it when a police officer confronts you, not to reach in your pocket, not to fight back, not to... Have you had to have those conversations with your kids?
No, and I pray I don't have to. I pray that this change prevents that time from coming. I'm grateful that they're 10, 9, and 5 at the moment because they're focused on being better brothers, and they just really love basketball. And they're into this gaming thing that I don't like, but that's about it. Like, my kids are so happy. Like, they're so happy that they're distracted by their own happiness, which I'm not going to intervene on because they're kids. The moment I tell them that, it matures them a little bit.
My guess is that if you were living in South Central or Compton or somewhere like that,
you would
you'd have to have that conversation of how to behave, how to react if stopped.
Petey, you said when you were a kid, you were growing up, there was constant sirens and there was constantly the hum of the chopper overhead and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're talking about re-envisioning police departments and, you know, funding them less and funneling that funding into other social services.
Mm-hmm.
So all communities are not created equal, obviously. And, you know, today is a different day than 20 years ago. But when you look back on the, some of the communities that you're familiar with, what would it look like if there were less police there? Would it be better? Would it be worse? You know, what is that a solution, like more services, less cops?
Less police isn't the solution to me. I think more education is the solution. And I posted something the other day. I have my brother post. I don't do social media anymore. I have my brother run all my accounts. So I just send him things from what I'm reading and information so he can share. I was reading, I wish I could pull it up right now, but in other countries, they require way more education before you can become a cop.
Yeah.
And here it's just high school, take a test, boom, you're a cop. There need to be mental health tests and checks, background checks to the deepest core, and then education, like pure. Like if you have to go to college for 4 years to become a police officer, you should. If we do that for doctors and lawyers,
yeah,
it's the same thing. And that's what it absolutely should be implemented.
Yeah, and maybe a crash course in constitutional rights, Steve?
Yeah, that too.
I teach it.
You should memorize it.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff's important when you're out there, yeah, you know, enforcing the law. Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's good to know. There you have it from the source.
Yeah, I mean, the training, I think, is the key so that they know what's appropriate to do in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like in basketball, it's what we'd call muscle memory.
Right.
You don't have to think, what do I do? I'm confronted by this situation. You've been through it a million times, at least by virtually or by training or mm-hmm. whatever. And you know, this is a situation where you've got to use your gun. The vast majority of them, they don't. And we had a guest on here a few months ago, Steve Sobroff, who's president of the LAPD Police Commission. And he was saying that the number of times that police officers actually fire their guns is phenomenally low. He said, I forget the figures, but it's amazingly low compared with the public perception that it happens a lot. So I don't know that it's necessarily just firing guns. I think a lot of it is attitude mm-hmm. and, you know, valuing the lives of everybody, regardless of their skin color or mm-hmm. their culture or their religious background or any mm-hmm. of that.
And to piggyback on the training,
yeah,
specifically unbiased training.
Yeah.
Because the system has obviously been trained and conditioned a certain way. And there seems to be a bias.
Even training in the awareness of that bias.
Yeah.
And
that's,
I mean,
that's the key, because we can all be trained. Like, I know tons of basketball trainers that just teach them whatever they just looked up on YouTube. Versus me, I approach it. Every kid is entirely different.
Yeah,
different physically, mentally, emotionally. So when I train a kid, I'm training him based off his own specific set of needs.
Yeah, you meet that kid where he is.
And the system can't do that, of course. But everybody should have the fair opportunity to receive justice, and they should feel secure.
Yeah, that's after all what policing is meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I played basketball in high school. I never, when I went to UCLA, the freshman team had a guy at the time known as Lou Alcindor, mm-hmm. now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The most phenomenal freshman team ever, and they went on to win 3 national titles. Anyway, I was not that caliber by a long shot. But I'm a basketball junkie, and when I read about Program Humble, I wanted to find out more about it. So will you tell our listeners a little bit more about it?
It's a youth basketball program based in Pacific Palisades. It was created to bridge the gap between inner city kids and kids in the Pacific Palisades, using basketball as the source. And from coaching, training, private semis, groups, clinics, camps, mentorship. I mean, these kids can talk to me. And I literally just had a conversation with a kid at the beach workout about his energy and how to fix his attitude when things are hard. I mean, it's a 24-hour service. And my coaches are all my family, my assistant coach, and my assistant and head coach is LaBrie, my brother. After that, Coach Brian, who was my co-captain in high school. And then we have Chris and Raheem and RJ, who all played for me. My first high school AAU team, I trained them, I developed them, and they all coach for me now. And they've all matured and they're 21, 22, 23 years old, fresh out of college. And it's a family-oriented program. And I wish that I could get more kids from the inner city and fund them because they're provided scholarships by me specifically. I use my own money. I don't take from the program. I use my own money and I fund. We have 9 kids right now, scholarship kids. I had 21, but it was burying me. It was putting me under, and I didn't let them go, but I still keep in touch. But that's the goal. The goal is to get more inner city kids.
Do you raise money to provide for them?
No, or? I just work more. Simple as that.
Have you thought about it?
Yeah.
Trying to raise money?
Yeah, I have. And we're not a nonprofit, which makes my situation a lot different. We're a for-profit, and I've just handcrafted everything in this program the past 5 years and started with 2 teams, and now we have 11. And, you know, after this pandemic dies off, we could continue the growth. And our teams are phenomenal. We have some elite teams. We have some teams in the middle. We have brand new teams. We have one girls team that has been committed from the beginning. And kudos to them because it's hard. The statistics show that most girls stop playing at 12 and 13 years old. And our girls are 13 right now, and they have ambitions to play in the WNBA. Mm-hmm. And our Zoom sessions have been all about the WNBA, how to get more marketing in the WNBA, how to get more respect in women's basketball, and I'm all aboard.
Your girls' team played Kobe Bryant's,
Kobe's
right?
daughter's team. Yeah. We played them numerous times.
Yeah. And how many boys' teams do you have?
10.
That's a lot of kids, and they're mostly from around here. I mean, I know you've
Palisades, Venice, Santa Monica, Inglewood.
Yeah. And I have to say, your personality permeates your coaching. It's not like, it's not just Petey's going to teach you handles. Petey gives his values. You know, I feel like part of what you're doing, you said you were working on all those tracks, you know, to get into some sort of city advisory board. You know, you do your music, but your coaching is also you giving a little bit of your life experience to these kids and, you know, telling them about a work ethic or working hard or persevering or even, you know, not resorting to drugs just to get through a tough day. So, I mean, is that something you do purposefully?
I do it intuitively. It's just the way I can't hold it out, hold it in. It's just a passion. It just naturally comes out in everything I do.
Yeah. So
that comes across.
Yeah. And I want to say Program Humble is huge in the Palisades,
yeah,
right? I
mean, it's crazy.
I mean, a big part of the Palisades. Your families believe in you. You do. Tell us about the charity work. A couple of times a year, you...
Oh, yeah. We feed the homeless. We always have done it. I've always done it. Even before the Humble program began, we go to Skid Row. We feed them. We do a fundraiser for Thanksgiving to where we donate food to the food banks. We also... I created a toy drive to where we raise toys, and every parent and family donates toys and funds for families in my neighborhood. And we go to my neighborhood on Christmas Day from morning to wherever we're done, and we go door to door and we hand out toys to the kids. The teams, it's phenomenal. Last year we had 1,500 gifts, the most we've ever raised. And before, the year before that was 500, and the year before that was like 200, and then it was 50. Like, it's insane. Last year was insane. Like, I have to literally get a church now. I rent a church like down the street, and I'll put up flyers door to door, and I'll have everyone come to me this time because
that's incredible. That's how
exhausted.
Much you're growing. That is incredible.
Good for you.
Yeah, it's been great.
It's inspiring.
Yep. And cups, is that what they're called in basketball when you win tournaments? You have a few of those. Don't you have a few teams that are placed?
I have a lot of trophies. My 10U team was number 10 in Southern California before the quarantine, and my 12U team, which is the original boys team from the program, they are number 9, 24 in the state, 9 in Southern California.
Those are pretty impressive stats. Am I wrong?
Absolutely, they are. It's phenomenal. It's a nice thing that you're doing for the community, not just in the Palisades, but surrounding areas. It's impressive.
Everything about your story is impressive, Petey. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
It
was
a lot.
Really
Thank
a pleasure.
You. Thank you. All we need is love.